when he was out in the yard looking up at Will's window. Why? He wanted Will. He was in love, and he was out in the dark and the cold, looking up at the one thing he wanted. And I'm him now. I'm James. Out in the yard in the cold, looking up at the window, wanting what I love to look out and see me, to come down and talk to me and give me a chance.
Yes, Rita said, nodding. I can see that.
I'm looking up at Eric's window. He went down to talk to James, but he won't come down for me.
You both broke each other's hearts.
I changed, she exhaled, heavy and dark. But Eric was... He liked when things behaved the way he expected them to.
And people.
Well, sure.
Including you. Especially her.
But she had fallen apart. Smashed like a window, and scattered in pieces. She hadn't behaved the way he expected,
and he left.
But it was my fault, she said, and noticed the words didn't cut quite as deeply as before.
You were shot, Rita said quietly. The girl he expected, and the behavior he expected, were shot.
It doesn't excuse it,
but it helps explain it.
Daisy closed her eyes and reached soft hands to touch the things which had been beyond her control.
She had to agree.
Farfar Oak Farmore.
The company was in the final rehearsals for the season premiere of Aida. In a week, Daisy would be bare-legged on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House. Scars out in the open. To explore the options of covering them, she knocked on the tiny office door of Vincent Calegro, the new head of the Met's makeup department. He was eating a sandwich and doing the crossword and didn't look thrilled by the interruption. He had a reputation for being intolerant of divas, fools, or drama. She introduced herself and got to the point. I'll be quick, she said, rolling up the left leg of her sweatpants. Can we do anything about these? Or do you think anyone will even notice? Vincent's face was expressionless as he stared at her leg and finished chewing and swallowing. I'm interrupting your lunch. I'll come back, she said. Vincent wiped his mouth and looked up at her with hooded, unreadable eyes.
Two things, he said. First, you're the little girl who went on in La Gioconda last week.
She nodded, her face filling with warm pride. The Met always hired stars from American Ballet Theater to lead the famous Dance of the Hours ballet in Gioconda's third act. Just before curtain, Matilda Schenke tripped on a loose cable and sprained her ankle. Next thing Daisy knew, she was being sewn into Matilda's $15,000 red tutu, while Igor Koslov, one of ABT's Russian superstars and now her partner, was shaking her hand. They had exactly 20 minutes of rehearsal, and then she was on stage, unannounced and anonymous in front of a full Saturday night subscription house, dancing half the steps from memory and the rest from Igor's whispered cues. She blanked out on the choreography for her solo in the coda, so she whipped out double and triple fouetté turns until the audience was screaming. She and Igor took four bows, and the Times threw her a posy in the Sunday art section. Matilda Schenke took an unfortunate fall before the third act. An unidentified understudy took over the role and took home the audience's heart as well. Hopefully, we'll see this mystery ballerina again while Schenke is on the mend. Second, Vincent said, and bent over to raise the leg of his pressed trousers. Above his argyle sock, the scar was unmistakable. Wow, that's a beauty, Daisy said, her stomach doing a small flip. I ordered the matching set. She twisted her leg so he could see the other side. He nodded, a smile lifting up his mouth and a bit of his stiff reserve slipping off his shoulders.
Quite a thing to wake up to. I took one look at my flesh bulging out and they had to sedate me again.
I screamed for about 5 minutes and then I threw up. Then they sedated me.
Well, well, he said, rolling his pant leg down again. It's not often I'm surprised this way, Miss Bianco.
Daisy, what happened to you? She asked, heart thumping a little stronger.
To strangers, I say a freak accident. To you, I will confess to screwing around with fireworks. One exploded near a bucket of nuts and bolts. I turned just in time to take it in the leg. Then an infection set in. Next thing I know, I'm auditioning for Silence of the Lambs.
Daisy laughed.
He cleared a space on his desk. Put your foot up here, dear.
Still holding her pant leg out of the way, she set her foot carefully between sketchbooks, watercolor sets, and papers. Vincent put on his reading glasses and peered.
This looks like a gunshot wound, he said, pointing to her thigh.
It is. The bullet severed the artery. My leg didn't take kindly to the graft, and the pressure started building up.
You know the rest. Tell me, how does a ballerina find herself in the line of fire?
When she goes to school at Lancaster University? A silence shimmied between them.
I see,
he said, setting a warm, respectful hand on her shin.
Then these cannot be your only scars.
She shook her head.
I'm sorry,
he said.
I have no other words.
You know, she said, believe it or not, this is the first time I've thrown the topic out to someone casually. I mean, voluntarily. She smiled, letting her eyes and nose wrinkle. I'm only just learning how to talk about it, and truthfully, I don't know what we're supposed to say now.
Well then, we'll go back to the matter at hand. Will anyone notice? The question is, my dear, will you mind if people notice? Because my job is to either transform you into someone else, or make you feel beautiful as you are. If you need help with either, I'm your man.
Daisy's throat grew warm, partly with gratitude, partly because his Italian accent was so reminiscent of Marie Della Michi. For opening night, I mind, she said. Maybe in time, I won't.
Come early at dress rehearsal then, he said. You can watch me do it, learn how, and in time you can cover them yourself as you see fit.
All right. Thank you.
No, Miss Bianco,
he said, shaking her hand and laying his other one on top.
Thank you.
The encounter gave her courage, as did finding a bearer of the same war flag. And a week later, when she stood on a table in the dressing room and Vincent explained to his assistants various techniques for covering the scars, she felt almost blasé. People passing through stopped and stared, openly curious. Some asked questions, making exclamations of shock, disbelief, or concern at her answers. Whenever she started feeling self-conscious, she looked down at Vincent, who winked over the rims of his glasses or smiled at her. It was a novelty for a few weeks. As telling the story became more and more natural, it became ordinary. A line on her resume, not the caption on her headshot. You can make your remorse ordinary, you know, Rita said. Daisy was skeptical. It seemed remorse had taken permanent possession and put down roots too deep to yank out. Let's just accept it, Rita said. You will always be sorry for what you did to Eric. It matters, deeply. But you can let your sorrow accompany you on the road of life without letting it be the road itself, without letting it define the rest of your life. You don't have to walk around with a scarlet A on your chest. It could be part of everything. I'm sorry. I will always be sorry, Daisy said slowly. I love you. I will always love you. But no, Rita said, holding up a finger. No but. And. And? Daisy said. And. Rita said. I love you. I will always love you, Daisy said. And I am moving on. You can do both at the same time. And, Daisy said, staring. What else? Rita said. I love you, and I'm letting go. What else? I'm sorry. I will always be sorry. I love you, I will always love you, and Daisy drew in her breath. And I'm forgiving myself. It became her mantra, changing but to and, whispering or thinking, I'm sorry, I love you, and I forgive myself.
when the sorrow threatened to drown her, in the night. Trusting she could do all things simultaneously, channeling the regret into a section of her being, not letting it become her entire being. She picked at the tight stitches on her invisible scarlet letter and gradually let it fall free. It belonged in a keepsake box of learned lessons, not on her chest as a constant shaming reminder, as if she could forget. Spring came. She went around bare-legged, letting the air and sun touch her scars. Trees and flowers bloomed in the park, and space bloomed in her apartment. She shoved things aside in closets and dressers to make room for John.
"I just realized the date," he said,
setting down an armload of boxes.
"Tomorrow is April 19th.
"It is? You're right, I lost track of time.
4 years,
he said. She touched his face. "Seems a good day to make a beginning." He hummed agreement, but his eyes were off to the side. She followed their gaze to the cardboard box where she kept the things Eric left at J Street. She'd have to get creative if it was going to go back in her closet. Or maybe it was time to accept she had no room for it anymore. She wasn't on stage that night. After John left for work, she unpacked the box. Jeans and 3 shirts. Eric's pocket knives and Allen wrenches. Guitar picks, strings, and a capo. His book of Swedish folktales. The rest were the pictures, cards, and notes she pulled out of his waste paper basket. She held the clothes to her nose, but they only smelled of cardboard. Her fingers dipped into the front pocket of the jeans, pulled out a crumpled dollar bill, a dime and 4 pennies, and some lint. The other front pocket had a couple of small screws and washers and a guitar pick, and more lint. She searched the other pockets, then gazed down at the small pile.
"Honestly," she said.
She gathered John's bag of dirty laundry along with the contents of the bathroom hamper, added Eric's clothes, and took it all to the washing machines in the basement. "Enjoy the threesome," she thought, slamming the lid and giving the dial a vicious spin. Back upstairs, she fished from a hidden compartment in her jewelry box a small scotch-taped lock of Eric's hair. She put it into an envelope and added the pocket finds and the lint. From another hidden place, she pulled a packet of love notes, cards, pictures, the empty bag of Swedish fish, and all the other keepsakes. Everything went into an accordion folder on her closet shelf, behind her bank statements and tax returns. She wasn't ready to throw the mementos away. Probably she never would. But she could handle assembling them in one unemotional place, up high and out of sight. She sank onto the bed and opened the book of folktales. She couldn't remember how it had gotten into her room at J Street, part of the invisible migration of objects back and forth. The text was entirely in Swedish, peppered with umlauts, slashed O's, and ringed A's. Eric couldn't read it, but he loved the pictures. Every other page was a full-color illustration, giants, trolls, and werewolves, golden queens and princesses in glass mountains, roosters, lame dogs, and hornet swarms. The inside flyleaf was inscribed in neat, looped handwriting, a Christmas dedication to a grandson. "Till Byron Eric,
med charlek vid jul, farfar och farmor."
Swedes had different terms for maternal and paternal grandparents, Daisy remembered. Farfar was father's father. Farmor was father's mother. On the back flyleaf, in careful childish print, Eric Fiskara, 307 Hugunnan Street, Clayton, New York. She fetched the laundry, folded Eric's clothes, smoothing them square and trim. She packed the other possessions tied around them and put the book on top. She let it go with a sighing regret, not a crippling grief. The box was just a box now, not a shrine. The religion had gone out of his belongings. The next day, after John left to run some errands, she squared her shoulders and dialed Eric's number. One more time. She didn't go in crawling, but standing on her feet, head on his level. He'd ignored her for 3 years. Rita said his statute of limitations was over. It bolstered Daisy's courage, having the tiny bit of reassurance that Eric, perhaps, was slightly in the wrong now as well. The same hollow silence on the other end of the line, although he did manage,
Hi.
It's the 19th, she said. I was thinking about you.
That's right.
His voice was tight, as usual, like he was threading words through a needle. And yet her ear thought it detected the tiniest bit of hesitation, as if he weren't fully committed to this strategy anymore. A flickering flame of conciliation. She let her breath hover over it, fighting the urge to pile on tinder and kindling. How are you?
She said. I'm fine, and I have to go.
The flame snuffed itself out, leaving only a wisp of smoke.
I'm late for a game.
Eric, please. It's been 3 years. She kept her voice low and gentle, the voice she used with the drug-addicted babies. I know it hurts. Please know that I know, Eric. Are we ever going to talk about this?
Silence.
She closed her eyes. Please, let's talk about it. It doesn't have to mean reconciliation, but it's been 3 years. We're older, we're wiser. Can't we have a conversation? He hung up.
Daisy opened her eyes.
They were dry as she put the phone down. She tore a piece of paper in half and wrote one last note to say she was sorry. He would never know how much. She would love him until she died. And she was done now. She taped the note to the inside of the box and taped the flaps shut. Before leaving the apartment, she wrote a second note, letting John know she was going to the post office. It was important her boyfriend know where she was. Not bad, Marge. Julie Valente convinced her to go to Chicago, where they were holding non-union auditions for Phantom of the Opera.
I don't sing, Daisy said.
You're auditioning for the ballerinas, Julie said. You don't have to sing. And anyway, you have a sweet little voice.
I do not. You know, when I don't hear you talking to yourself, those are private conversations.
I hear you singing to yourself. You're right on pitch. Probably with regular voice lessons, you could have some decent game. The idea of a girls' weekend away was more appealing than the audition. And in Chicago, where Daisy had never been.
It'll be fabulous, Julie said. My girlfriend practically lives on top of Wrigley Park. We can watch a ball game from her roof. We'll have the quintessential Windy City tour.
Go, John said. Have a good time.
With Julie's help, Daisy put her resume in order. Starting with a training at the Gladwin Academy of Dance, her acceptance into the junior company of the Philadelphia Youth Ballet when she was only 12, Lancaster Conservatory awarding her the Brighton Scholarship, her roles and her degree, the year in the Corps of the Pennsylvania Ballet, ending with her present employment at the Metropolitan Opera.
Not bad, she thought, considering I got shot and had a bit of a mental breakdown along the way.
You're talking to yourself again, Julie said.
Private conversation, Daisy said. Do you mind?
I miss you, John said on the phone.
Daisy lay on her back in the nest of the hotel bed. The ceiling swayed slightly.
I'm a little lit, she said.
It's not even 9 o'clock.
I know, drinking beer in the sun at the ball game, but I don't know how many bottles of wine at dinner. I'm going to be hurting on the plane tomorrow.
How did the audition go?
I didn't get kicked or put.
Didn't get what?
She tried again.
Picked or cut.
Oh my God, you are lit.
I made it to the third round. Got singled out a lot. 6 of us were left by the end, and we had to sing. But they don't tell you if you got a role. They'll keep your name, headshot, and resume on file, and if they need someone on the tour, they'll call.
I see. Well, it's good experience.
She turned on her side, curling up to the phone.
What did you do today?
Worked out, got my ass kicked. Took master class with Danilo Fuertes, got my ass kicked. Stage fighting workshop. We learned the street scene from Romeo and Juliet. I nearly got impaled with a sword. Came home tired and horny to an empty apartment. Poor me.
Daisy giggled.
Poor you.
Took a shower and thought about my gorgeous girlfriend's hot body.
Talk slower.
Rubbed one out.
What was I doing?
Helping.
And what did you do?
Cuddled with myself and fell asleep. Got up, made something to eat, puttered around. My brother called, wanting to go out, trying to decide if I'll go or stay here and be horny.
Again?
Again. It's a chronic condition.
What's the cure?
Your ass back in New York where it belongs.
Tomorrow.
Drink a lot of water. I'll be on you whether you're hungover or not.
Promise?
I'm putting the cum in homecoming.
She smiled against the phone. Night, Opie. I love you.
I love you, he said. And don't fucking call me Opie.
She and Julie shared a cab from LaGuardia. It dropped Daisy on 110th Street, where she could pick up a crosstown bus to the west side. See you at the slave pens, Julie said, blowing a kiss out the window. You're my favorite. Daisy blew a kiss back and waved. The late August afternoon was glorious. The humidity had calmed. A lengthening in the sun's shadows hinted at fall. On one side of the street, storefronts announced back-to-school sales. On the other, Central Park reared up yellow and green. Daisy gazed out the bus window at her city. She realized she was happy. Her chest was open. Her stomach was calm. She stood out at a musical theater audition and made the final cut. Possibly she could get a job out of it. But she already had a job. She was making it. She was paying her way, doing what she loved. In the Big Apple, warm and gold on an August evening. She was home. She had done it. Not bad, she thought again, smiling at her reflection. Not bad at all, Marge. She transferred to the Columbus Avenue bus and rode smiling to 86th Street, where she pulled the bell and alighted into the soft air. The skies over New Jersey were turning pink and orange. Maybe she and John could take a walk over to Riverside Park tonight, go out to eat. After homecoming, of course.
Where's Johnny?
She called in the front hall. Silence. She set her keys down and heeled off her shoes.
The mistress of the house hath returned.
More silence. She wondered if he was sleeping. Bag still on her shoulder, she rifled through the mail. Bills and the latest dance magazine, and an airmail envelope with Will's address.
What's up, asshole? She said, happily.
Hi.
She looked up. John stood in the hall. He did not look happy to see her. To the point where Daisy ran a quick moral inventory, wondering what she could have possibly done.
What's wrong?
She said. He crossed his arms and leaned against the wall.
Eric called.
For a crystal second, the universe seized. Then Daisy's heart gave a lurch and dropped a load of adrenaline from her chest into her stomach.
Careful, her mind warned her. Be extremely careful right now, Marguerite.
When? She said.
Last night.
She stared at him. Sweat trickled from armpit to elbow as her heart kicked her breastbone with thick, audible thuds.
Oh,
she said. She let her bag slide off her shoulder to the floor. What did he want? She asked. Her voice was steady, but her body had gone numb. She was nothing but air and stomach and that pounding, thudding heart.
He was looking for something.
Her throat tightened up.
Don't cry, she thought. Don't you fucking start crying.
Looking for what?
It would help if John would be a little less elusive.
His necklace. The gold one he used to wear. You know.
Now tears prickled her eyes.
He lost it?
That's what he said.
Oh.
She swallowed hard.
Well, that sucks. It was an heirloom.
All the men in his family wore.
I know what it was, Daisy. Where is it?
I don't know.
The accusation should have filled her with outrage. Instead, the clamp around her throat tightened with something that felt like guilt.
I don't have it, she said, feeling on trial. Everything I had of his went back to him in that box.
Are you sure you didn't keep it back as bait?
Are you seriously doing this? She asked. Springing this on me the second I walk in the door, hinting I have something to do with him calling?
How did he get our number?
She held out her hands.
Maybe he called my parents. Maybe he called directory assistance. It's not like I'm in hiding.
Do you have his necklace?
I do not have it. I don't have anything of his. I sent it all back. I moved on.
They glared at each other, prickling and defensive.
Did he say anything else?
Daisy asked. She meant to be conversational, but it came out reeking of desperation.
What did he want? What? Tell me what he said. How did he sound? What did he want?
Something was smug in John's narrowed eyes, as if he hoped she would ask. He asked how you were, he said. And I said you were fine now. Told him it was bad before. He asked how, and I said you'd been cutting yourself.
You told him that?
You're goddamn right I did. Her face numb. She opened her mouth and closed it a couple times. Well, she said, that was my story to tell, but... Oh, your story, he said, his voice raising. Sure, I have nothing to do with it. I'm just the guy who found you bleeding in the bathroom. That makes me a bit player in this drama.
It does not. John, you...
Good. Then, as your live-in boyfriend, I told him I'd appreciate if he wouldn't make a habit of calling, John said. I was pretty nice about it. Not that I think he deserves it. And not that anyone gives a shit what I think. Grabbing his keys, he pushed past her, heading for the door and muttering under his breath. Son of a bitch couldn't make a fucking phone call when you were in a death spiral 3 years ago. Now he finds the stones to call, and he gets me. Little old Opie. He looked back at her with a cruel expression she barely recognized. It was fucking beautiful days. I enjoyed hearing him squirm. I relished it. Relish was the word.
John, stop it. Don't leave. I'm just...
The door slammed.
Surprised.
Fuck. With a groan of frustration, she slid down the wall to sit on the floor, face in her hands.
You called, she said. Now you call me? Now? What, you think I didn't mean it all those other times? I send your stuff back and then you decide?
She was crying, half in exhausted despair, half in primal triumph.
He called. He didn't have my number. He had my address, but he didn't have my number. He had to go looking for it. He came looking for me. He wanted me.
No, she said, getting up, mopping her face.
No, this is not fair. You do not get to do this to me. You had a chance. You had 3 years. You missed it. You're too late.
He called me. He came looking for me. Eric. Eric, why did you? Where are you? How could you?
She lay on the couch, filled with anger and crushed with sorrow. She was so happy 5 minutes ago. Now a bomb had gone off and everything she worked for, all her achievements, were worthless again.
I missed him. I wasn't here. My back was turned. He called and I wasn't here. It's not fair.
You can't, she said.
I have worked too hard, Eric. You can't do this.
His necklace was lost.
Was it really, or was it an excuse he made up?
That necklace meant the world to him. It was his history, and she added herself to it. The tiny pair of gold scissors had been her gift to him, one of their first private jokes when she thought, upon first hearing his surname, that it meant scissors. Lost.
I'm sorry,
she whispered.
If it's lost, I feel terrible. It was your treasure, but I don't have it. I don't have anything anymore, Eric. I'm sorry. I have nothing for you.
He called.
Her heart sang, ignoring her.
He called. He called. I knew he would. I knew he'd come back.
Shut up, she said.
She pulled a pillow over her head, clamped it to her ear as if that could shut out the cacophony of emotion.
Shut up, she said.
A manic laugh poked through the weeping.
Stop talking to yourself.
She was losing her mind. This was it. She was certifiable now.
Someone kill me,
she said, laughing and crying.
Please, what the fuck?
He called me. He came looking for me. He came back.
At the sound of the door closing, she woke up.
The apartment was dark and cold. The air conditioning was up too high. She was curled tight against the crease between the bottom cushions and the top, her feet tucked within. John turned on a lamp, filling the living room with gold. He took the blanket off the rocking chair and came to her, shaking it out, tucked it around her. Then he sat cross-legged on the floor, elbows on knees, hands folded up around his mouth.
"I figure I had a dozen ways to handle that situation," he said. "I wanted to go with the worst, so I picked territorial asshole. How was it?"
"Epic," she said.
"Jealous douche was my second choice."
"I could leave and come in again. You could give jealous douche a try."
"Then I wouldn't have the element of surprise."
"True. A lot depended on me."
"It does."
One of his hands dropped lightly on her head, smoothing her hair.
"I'm sorry,"
he said. She put her hand on his, fingers intertwining. "Thank you."
"I was just a jealous territorial lunatic, and I had to pee on what was mine."
She chuckled under her breath.
"It threw me off when he called. So springing it on you made me feel back in control. I'm sorry."
"I'm glad I wasn't here when he called."
"Are you?"
"I don't have anything of his. I don't have anything for him." She put her hand on John's face, snugged his jaw into her palm, and ran her thumb along his cheekbone. He turned his mouth into her and exhaled.
"I need to say something, and I just want you to listen to me."
She nodded.
"I love you. You know that. But I don't think you know how fiercely protective I feel of everything you've worked so hard to get back. You nearly killed yourself over him. You gave up the things you loved, and you starved yourself, cut open your old scars and cut new ones in your skin. And I feel protective about my role in this story. It's mine to tell too, because I found your scars, Days. I was the one you showed the glass to. I was the one who called for help. John, me, Days."
He shied from her caressing hand, and his eyes narrowed.
"I watched you fight back to this place. Watched you come home from therapy like a broken doll and then get up the next day and go back out to fight again. Watched you bleed and cry and hurt and fuck him if he thinks—"
His head dropped back into his hands.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I know he was hurt, and I know he's not a malicious person at heart, but I only had to hear his voice on the phone to think I was going to lose you."
"You won't." She ran gentle fingers through his hair, but he still seemed wary of her touch. She took her hand away and let him be.
"Fuck him, Days,"
he said.
"He had his chance. 3 years of making it crystal clear he couldn't have cared less if you lived or died. 3 years when he couldn't give you the time of his fucking day. He's out of chances. He doesn't get to pick and choose. He doesn't get to dictate your state of mind anymore. I live here now, and I am not going to step aside, invite him in, and watch him destroy you again."
"He won't, honey." She pushed the blanket aside, slid off the couch into his lap. She wrapped both legs and arms around him. "He won't," she said, rocking their bodies. "He was looking for something, and I don't have it. And if he was looking for me, I'm not her anymore." She held him tight, rocked with him until a trembling shook his shoulders and his arms went around her waist.
"I missed you,"
he said along her neck. "I'm home." She took his head and set her eyebrows on his. "So are you. You're more than just the guy who picked up the pieces. You live here. I came home to you." That's it, too. "I got the job," Daisy said. "The Phantom Touring Company called a few nights ago, wanting me to play Meg Giri starting in January."
"Wow,"
Rita said. "Congratulations." "I went for my wig fitting. It was a scream. I fly to Chicago after New Year's for rehearsals and then join up with a tour in Michigan."
"How exciting."
"John got a job offer, too, from the Boston Ballet. It's a soloist contract and a really great opportunity."
"Is he going to take it?"
"He'd be crazy not to."
"What about your apartment?"
"Well, all these pieces seem to be falling into place.
Lucky and Ed broke up over Thanksgiving. She moved out and she's been living with her mother in Rockland County and commuting into the city. It's a horribly stressful situation, so we asked if she wanted to sublet from us and she couldn't pack up fast enough. It all came together. Daisy nodded.
As for John and I, it won't be easy. We're not kidding ourselves about it.
We'll have to wait and see what happens. And communicate, often. Daisy sighed. It's been a little tense since Eric called. How so? The phone rings and John narrows his eyes. I don't think he realizes he does it, but it's like he's braced. She spread her hands. And I'm human. I'm a girl. The compulsion to know what your ex-boyfriend wanted when he called out of the blue. I still have moments when I want to grab John and shake him and squeal like he's one of my girlfriends. Oh my God, tell me everything. What did he say? Rita smiled. Perfectly human. But I can't, she said. I can't ask him for the play-by-play. I mean, I can, but I won't. And he could tell me, but he won't. It's like this little power play. This tiny elephant on the bedside table, or a ghost dragging around two pathetic links of a chain. Not enough to haunt, but enough to be. And I find we're bickering over the stupidest things, like we can't fight about Eric, so we'll fight about who last bought toilet paper, or who ate all the leftover Chinese food. Daisy pulled on her ear, chewing on the silence. What if I need you while I'm on the road? Excellent question. If you get me a list of cities where you will be, I'll see if I can locate any colleagues in the area. But certainly, if you are in a crisis, you can call me, and I hope you will. I don't consider this relationship terminated because you are no longer seeing me on a regular basis. Daisy exhaled in relief. Ah, thank you. Were you worried? I just didn't know what the rules were. You can call me. If you want, drop me a letter every now and then. I can't counsel you by mail or be your pen pal, but I would love to know what's going on. I'll feel so much better knowing I can do that. I'm more than a little nervous, mostly because it's the unknown. Do you need refills on any of your scripts? Daisy drummed fingertips on her mouth. The Xanax is a little low. I'll write you one before you leave. How often are you taking it these days? Funny, not all that often, but I sure like knowing it's there. We call that the back pocket effect. Daisy smiled. They sat in silence a minute. It's occurred to me, Daisy said. It's been 3 years since I've seen Eric. 4 in April. I've now been away from him for as long as I knew him. She held out her hands, palms up, like scales. It's even now. We were together 3 years. We've been apart 3 years. Slowly she tilted the balance, raising one hand higher. And now the time away from him is going to start outweighing the togetherness. How does that make you feel? Daisy said, grinning. I feel like time really is an amazing thing. People tell you time heals all wounds. All things heal in time. All that shit your mother says while you want to scream. But I mailed back the box of Eric's things, and I couldn't believe how calm I was. I felt sadness, but it wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't in my veins or splitting my chest open. I talk about strong emotions being like a jacket I wear. This was a brooch on a jacket, not the entire garment. Rita nodded. This is huge, considering your state when you first came in to see me. Her fingers fluttered in calculation. It's November. 10 months you've been working. Not even a year. I thought my heart was literally broken. The way my chest felt like it was going to split open, I thought I was dying. And yet here you are. Alive. And coping. Quite well, I might add. I had a funny dream about Matryoshka, Daisy said. Russian nesting dolls. I collect them. I was here with you, and I was opening one, but it was like an infinite doll. I kept opening them and opening them. It got cartoonish, with piles of doll halves falling off the couch and building up on the floor. Rita's head tilted. Interesting. And then what happened?
I got to the end, to the last doll, and it was this microscopic speck. Daisy held out a cupped palm. Right there. This piece of invisible something in my hand. I held it up to you and said, "Is this it?" And you said, "Yep, that's it." I got really insistent. "Really? You're sure? This is it?" And you kept nodding, "Yes, yes." Then I pointed around the room to this unbelievable mess of doll halves, and I said, "Then what the hell is all that?" Rita laughed. "What did I say?" You said, "Well, that's it too." Rita brushed one hand against the other. "And now I retire." Daisy laughed.
"It wasn't hard to interpret."
She held up her palm again. "This is it. And the mess you make getting to this is part of it too." Out of the Ashes. A Lesson in Bleak. January 27, 1997. Dear Rita, I have the dubious honor of kicking off my gypsy lifestyle in Michigan.
In the middle of winter.
Pray for me. Before I joined, the tour just finished up their stop in East Lansing, which I hear is beautiful. We now occupy the Masonic Temple in Detroit for the next 4 months. The theater is beautiful. Detroit is not. Detroit in winter is a lesson in bleak, a study in neutral tones. Everything is gray, brown, and white, and flat. Frankly, it's depressing. But if I can get through this leg of the tour and not expire from seasonal affectation disorder, then I think it's safe to say I can live pretty much anywhere. I'm settling into the routine. We're put up at a pretty good hotel with extended stay accommodations, meaning we have access to a kitchen, and I've become an unofficial cast cook. As long as someone else is willing to food shop, I don't mind whipping up something that can be heated up after curtain. We get our own rooms, although a lot of cast members buddy up in order to bank half the per diem. I might do that eventually, but for the moment, I'm being selfish and solitary about my personal space. I'm reading a ton. The amount of books lying around the green room and the dressing rooms is not to be believed. And puzzles and board games, too. Backstage looks like a combination of a Red Cross knitting circle and a nursing home rec room. Tuesday through Friday, we do only one evening show, so my days are free until around 4 in the afternoon. I've acquired a GBF, a gay best friend. His name is Gabriel Osten, and he is fabulous. He's an amazing dancer with a fearless ability to hustle, like he knows how to work his inner agent. He walked right into the offices of the Detroit Ballet School, dragging me behind. He introduced himself and got us both enrolled in professional-level classes. And he's organizing a small group to perform with Detroit City Dance Festival next month. As long as it doesn't interfere with the tour's rehearsals or shows, we're allowed outside engagements. This is all fantastic because I was worried my ballet technique would suffer while I was on the road. Now I see being in different cities is actually a huge opportunity to study. I just follow Gabriel and let him do the talking. Weekends are intense with two shows on Saturdays and Sundays. Mondays we have off, and I use that day to get a massage or a manicure, go shopping, or do something nice for myself. John and I are managing. A lot of phone calls and letters, but the separation is taking a toll. Our schedules simply don't coincide, and trying to coordinate time to see each other is proving both a logistical and financial challenge. I feel sad. Not heartbroken, but he's been so good to me, and I do love him. He's dear to me, and I'll always want to know where he is. If this ends, I don't want to be totally disconnected or have things be unfinished. Anyway, that's where things stand. Now I bundle up and head off to the theater. I hope you're well. Take good care. Daisy. The letters dwindled to notes. The phone calls became more and more infrequent, and the conversations grew more and more like small talk. It was over by March.
"I didn't want to do this over the phone," John said.
"We're 700 miles and a time zone apart," Daisy said. "It was kind of unavoidable."
"Breaking up?"
"No, the phone part."
"Right."
A long, aching silence, edged with static.
Fuck, he said. How do you do this without all the stupid cliches?
It's not you, it's me, she said.
It is me, he said. To be honest, God, I don't know how to say this.
Another wedge of silence. Then the mental clouds parted, and Daisy felt her eyes widen.
Holy shit, she said. Did you meet someone?
Of all the ways he could have reacted, she didn't expect him to start crying.
Honey, don't, she said. John, it's all right.
As if it were storyboarded in front of her, she knew exactly what happened. He met a girl and connected with her. She liked him, openly, spontaneously, and freely. No shadows from the past lurked over their shoulders, no eggshells underfoot to brush aside or topics of conversation to avoid. No scars under their fingertips when they touched. He liked her. She liked him. End of story. Whether it was an affair of the heart or a sex fest, it was no doubt refreshingly mindless and simple and healthy and accessible. John probably wanted to stuff his face with it and collapse into a stupor of contentment.
I'm sorry, he said. It was the last thing I expected.
Me too, she thought.
Is she in the company?
She's in the orchestra.
After a beat, he added,
she plays viola,
as if it explained everything. I see.
I'm sorry, Daze, he said. I'm all torn up and I can't keep doing this. It makes my stomach hurt and it's not fair to you or Kelly.
Kelly was an ice water splash of reality. A name made it real. Daisy closed her eyes, feeling hurt and confused and with no right to either.
Let him go, she thought. You wanted it this way, after all.
You got the breakup you hoped for. She opened her eyes and told him he deserved to get all the love he wanted to give. He deserved his passion reciprocated, deserved what she couldn't.
Fucking cliches, she said.
I hate conversations like this.
I love you, she said. I wouldn't be here, anywhere, if it weren't for you. It's the truth, and it's what I'll take with me for the rest of my life.
I'd do it again, he said. I wouldn't change anything. I'll always love you, Daze. It's just...
I know. You're worthy of more, she thought. You want to be loved completely. Right now. Today.
They lingered on the line, each clearly feeling more should be said. Their breakup deserved more time. Stay in touch, she said. Please don't disappear.
A tiny chuckle. I'm not Eric.
Tears came to her eyes. No, you're not.
You're a prince.
He let out his breath.
I need to go now, honey,
he said. She let him go. And in the weeks following, she battled a low-grade emotional flu, confused by a phone that didn't ring when she expected it to, blinking at the box office manager's apologetic expression when her mailbox was empty, sideswiped by visions of John lying around in bed with this Kelly person and her damn viola. Then Daisy got pissed. A little. Her skin flared up hot, and she shivered with cold. Her heart moped and slammed a few doors, but it felt half-assed and phony, sulking because it was the thing to do. She didn't know what else to do. All the emotion was ill-fitting, as if it belonged to someone else's breakup.
You're pissed because you're lonely, she counseled herself. And John isn't. You're jealous. Just feel it. Let it sit in your lap a while. If it has something to say, it will, or else it will get up and leave.
It did leave, only to be replaced by an intense craving for physical contact, which she assuaged by sleeping with Gabriel Osten. This won't get you kicked out of the Gay Boys Club, will it? She said.
You'd be surprised how many gay boys like cuddling up with girls for a good night's sleep.
Really?
Really. You're soft, you're smooth, you fit nice in my arms, you don't snore, and you smell amazing. None of that gets me hard. Analyze it however you want, just don't wake me up.
He was the only boy who could successfully spoon Daisy for an entire night. None of her customary wide-eyed claustrophobia rose up when he wrapped his arms around her from behind. In fact, the first time, she went into such a deep sleep, she awoke in the exact same position, her bottom arm completely numb. "This is outstanding," she said. "Pillow talk and snuggles with no hassle or drama."
"Or wet spot,"
Gabriel said, yawning. "Why didn't I think of this years ago?"
"You were in a psychiatric hospital years ago, if I remember correctly."
She pummeled him hard with a pillow.
"Asshole." "I'm sorry, that was cheap. Lie back down, I'll play with your hair."
"This is the weirdest thing I've ever heard," Lucky said over the phone. "Listening to myself tell you about it, I agree, it's beyond weird," Daisy said. "On the other hand, I sleep great, I'm not lonely, and he's the world's most perfect back scratcher. So what the hell?"
"I may resort to this,"
Lucky said sourly. "I'm so horny, I'm rubbing against the furniture. Any dates?"
"None I could rub against.
By the way, you know the sex toy shop over on Amsterdam Avenue? They closed. Not another shop in 10 square blocks. I have to head down to the village this weekend and look for a bedside table boyfriend." "Yeah, speaking of which, I need batteries." The Report of Gunfire. April 22, 1997. The Cleveland Plain Dealer. Arts and Entertainment. Old Works and Fresh Faces, Cleveland Dance Movement Presents Emerging Artists. By Dillis Silverman. The Museum of Art was an exhibition of unparalleled generosity Monday night. Established community artists provided those lesser known a chance to shine in a collaborative gala performance. Together with Cleveland Choral Arts Society, the Chamber Symphony, and Cleveland Dance Movement, young composers, vocalists, and dancers took to the stage in both original works and classics. The apex of the evening came with a lacrimosa of Mozart's Requiem Mass. Set against the gorgeous haunting music and the equally breathtaking talent of the chorus was a pas de deux of such delicate emotion, I couldn't decide if it were heartbreaking or triumphant. Perhaps the beauty lay in its juxtaposition of both. The pas de deux was choreographed by Marguerite Bianco, who plays the role of Meg Giry in the touring production of Phantom of the Opera, currently running at Playhouse Square. When not performing or rehearsing, she and her partner, Gabriel Osten, teach and coach for Cleveland Dance Movement and other local schools. Bianco is an astonishing dancer who, for 4 minutes, made the spacious atrium of the museum into an intimate and timeless space. The audience was filled with longing by the time the choral Amen shook the windows, longing to see it from the beginning so we could dissect what, exactly, we had just seen. It was mournful but enlightened, grief-stricken yet courageous, joyful but with a dark edge, dark but with a wash of golden light. With stunning phrasing and interpretation, Bianco and Osten wrung the score into its extremes of heaven and hell. But how? What did we see? Bianco, who hails from Philadelphia, is a graduate of Lancaster University. Sunday, the 19th of April, was the 5th anniversary of the Lancaster shootings. It was the report of gunfire echoing in the choreography, the grief for friends in her endless extension, and the mourning of dreams in her phrasing. The triumph of a 20-year-old girl shot down and left to die, only to live and be told she might not walk again. What 500 people in the museum saw on Monday night was not a requiem mass, but a eulogy and an enduring love story of the highest order. "More coffee, miss?" Daisy looked up from the paper, checked her watch. "No, thanks." She read the article again while the waitress wrote up her check. Dillis Silverman, the Plain Dealer's art critic, was a humorless commentator who was known to skewer young, unknown artists alive. Daisy's heart had been in her throat when she first folded back the newspaper, expecting the worst at best and crucifixion at worst. Now her chest caved in with a triumphant relief that slowly rose up pink and warm into her face. An astonishing dancer. She secured some bills under the ketchup bottle, shrugged on her jacket, and left the coffee shop, heading over to Playhouse Square. Her stride was a strut, and her head floated above the column of her spine.
Mike, the security guard at the stage door, looked up and smiled as she signed in.
How are you today?
Astonishing, Daisy said. An email for me? Mike whistled the tune of Daisy Bell as he fetched the contents of her box. Letters from her mother and Lucky. A postcard from Will.
Having a wonderful time. Wish you were here.
She found Gabriel in the green room, surrounded by his posse, each with a copy of The Plain Dealer. They applauded as she came in, and Gabriel scooped her up in a spinning hug.
Dillis has a soul, he said. Hallelujah.
We rung the score into heaven and hell, she said, planting kisses on his face. How was the reception after? Gabriel set her down and picked up his newspaper.
You should have come.
I had to ice my ankle. What did I miss?
Oh, nothing.
His face was bland. Too bland. Daisy's eyes narrowed. Gabriel, she said, a warning note in her voice. His eyes on the page, he reached into his shirt pocket and brought out a business card. He snapped it with a flourish through his fingers as he handed it to Daisy.
For you, madame.
C. Harland Kent III, production assistant, Cleveland Art Museum. A phone number was underneath, underlined twice in pen. Who is he? Daisy said.
Well, from what I understand, a museum production assistant sets up the galleries for exhibitions and also sets up the stage when the museum presents a... Hold on, let me find it. An exhibition of unparalleled generosity.
Daisy closed her eyes. A stagehand, she said. Of course.
He was quite taken with you.
Daisy opened her eyes. Oh? Gabriel nodded. Nice guy?
The grief for friends in her endless extension and the mourning of dreams in her phrasing. Not bad. It's a little unctuous, but it is Dillis after all.
Gabe, don't toy with me.
The report of gunfire echoing in the choreography, not sound, but report.
This dame knows her way around the English language.
I'm sorry, did you say something?
You're going to make me beg, aren't you?
Yes.
She sighed. Is he cute? Please tell me.
No, he said. Seedy dresser and a definitive lives with mom air. Needs to find a new barber pronto. However, Gabriel held up a finger. Superb sense of humor and smart as fuck. And you being a museum junkie, he could probably give you an amazing private tour. I'd definitely go and have a cup of coffee.
All right, she said, looking over the business card. She shrugged. Maybe I'll get dinner out of it.
Or laid.
She smiled. I don't need to get laid. I have you.
Glorified cuddling with your gay roommate is not getting laid.
If you'd let me grind against you occasionally, it would be. Gabriel eyed her for a moment.
You need to get laid.
You secretly want me. I could totally turn you with my endless extension.
Ugh, the report of traumatized pussy in my bed. Just what I want.
It's the best kind, she cried, throwing her arms around him. He laughed against her head, one hand sliding down her back.
You have a nice ass, he said, giving it a caress and a squeeze. I'll give you that much.
April 26, 1997. Dear Lucky. Hello, darling girl. We gypsies are hitting the road again. I'm writing this in the airport on the way to Washington, D.C. for the next leg. Sending you a clip from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Lacrimosa was well received, and the arts critic, as you can see, did a bit of homework. In fact, I think she did more homework than me. I swear I never consciously set out to choreograph Lacrimosa as my I Am a Survivor piece. I just loved the music, and it made me see movement and steps and patterns. And Gabriel, of course, helped make it come to life. But maybe all along. I'm now listening to the other sections of the Requiem, thinking I have more to say. Or rather, I'm thinking the structure of the piece is telling a story. Perhaps my story. All of which has me dancing around the hotel room at odd hours and scribbling like mad in notebooks. We shall see what comes to pass. By the way, funny story, one of the dancers got all flustered and embarrassed when she read the review. The piece is called Requiem, she said. I thought it was Rakewind. Of course, the official name of the ballet is now Rakewind. Anyway, let me tell you about one C. Harland Kent III. You have to say his name with your teeth clenched and your jaw thrust out. You just did it.
didn't you?
He's a production assistant at the Cleveland Art Museum. He chatted Gabe up at the reception after the performance. I was back at the hotel, icing my ankle. It's been acting up. And he passed along his business card to give to me. A conquest, ladies and gentlemen. Gabe gave me a not cute, but a great personality description. But my inner geek was interested in knowing someone who works at an art museum, so I called him and suggested meeting for coffee and cornflakes after the show. No, this does not end well. See, Harland Kent is instantly cream yourself gorgeous. Like if Will and Eric had a love child. Dark hair, beautiful eyes, killer smile, insane body. Check, check, and check. And I show up at the coffee shop in post-performance loungewear with my wig-crushed hair and eyelashes still greasy with baby oil. I thought I would kill Gabriel. Looking like shit, I had to rely solely on my witty, sparkling conversation. For the record, the C is for Christopher, and his friends call him Trey, because his grandfather is Ace and his father is Deuce. Get it? You're not amused. Hold on, it gets worse. Also, for the record, in the presence of impossibly handsome men called Trey, I have no witty, sparkling conversation.